So hi, everybody. I had fairly good luck with a little technological infixing last week, so I'm going to try that again, and I'm going to say a few things and then play just about 5 minutes of a talk by Joan that we've actually played here in the last couple months as part of going some places that I would like to go. We spent a long time talking about the ordinary mind, Cohen, and we're finally done with that pretty much, so I'm going to use it as a jumping off point to talk about something pretty different. The ordinary mind, Cohen, as we talked about it, really evokes for us a really powerful and kind of sudden shift in Zhaozhou that I won't go into again, but that's summed up at the very end of the Cohen itself. At these words, Zhaozhou was suddenly enlightened. So the thing about the sort of sudden shift, a sudden illumination, is certainly one thing that Zen, and especially Cohen Zen, holds out for us. It's pretty typical in terms of looking at different perspectives for the Cohens to then throw a curveball into that and say something really different, and often it seems kind of ironic or mordant. And so right after that, Wu Man, who's the guy who compiles the Blue Cliff record, the Gateless Gate where this appears, says, even though Zhaozhou may be enlightened, he can truly get it only after studying for 30 more years, which seems like, you know, a long, long time to study. And it seems, again, it's not dismissive, but it kind of startles you off your infatuation with that one single moment that supposedly transforms everything. And so that kind of shift is one of those shifts of vantage or perspective that Zen is repeatedly kind of bumping into us to negotiate. And it's really that movement out sort of to something like the 30 years that I want to focus on today and maybe for a while next time I give a talk as well. And all that is something to do with what's often called integration, how you take a kind of deep insight that may come to you in practice and let it stay in your life and let it fructify in various ways. I'm reminded also of the Peter Hirschhoff thing that Joan quotes pretty often, where he says, it's not enough to know what Buddha nature is, you have to know what Buddha nature does. And it turns out that in terms of really not only knowing what Buddha nature does, but being able to manifest some of that, that even the 30 years is a kind of optimistic understatement. And I don't know who says this, but it's all over the Buddhist literature. Even Shakyamuni Buddha himself is only halfway there. So there's a lot of work to be done. So what I want to do now is I want to play about, as I said, about 5 minutes of a passage from the first of the retreat talks Joan gave. And it seems to me mostly what it evokes is that state that's like the moment of opening, or when things are feeling very opened out. That's a lot like what's evoked for us in the ordinary mind, Cohen. And there's a little moment in there where she says something different. And I remember about a month ago, I was listening to it and I thought, oh, there's trouble lurking here. There's a way to understand what she said that seems to me would kind of lead us in a direction that she doesn't normally go, and that most of us who've been practicing Zen for a while don't normally go. But that'll be a kind of jumping off point for some things that I want to discuss if the technological gods are friendly. So let's see. She's talking about pilgrims and masters, and those of you who were at the retreat, I'm sure, will remember this, and those of you who heard the talk might remember it as well.
About the quality of our friendship. A little while ago, I was speaking about the relationship between teachers and pilgrims, and how in the tradition, pilgrims are called clouds in water. So they're like Changsha, wandering in the mountains. They go here and there, they come and go, they wander, they change shape, they're always moving. And if we take Rinji's language, we might say they are willingly choosing the role of guest. Or more intimately, they are always guesting, coming and going, not staying anywhere for very long, always changing, clouds and water. And the teachers often have mountain names. So Dongshan, Daishan, Zaoshan, Yangshan, all those shans are mountains. So they are the ones who stay put, the ones who deeply root somewhere, the ones who give a place for mountains and waters to move and change. So we might say that they are willingly taking the role of host. They are always hosting. And when these hosts, these mountains, meet these guests, these clouds and waters, they ask questions of each other. And the mountains are always asking the clouds and waters, where have you come from? Which, because there's no tense in classical Chinese, also can be translated, where are you coming from? And when they leave again, they're always asking, where are you going? And the clouds and waters are always saying things like, I'm on pilgrimage. And the mountain asks, what is pilgrimage like? And the clouds and water says, I don't know. And the mountain says, that not knowing is most intimate. So to be a guest, to be a cloud in water, is to not know deeply, but to be on pilgrimage. And the pilgrims are always asking the mountains, what's the scenery like at your place? What does it look like there? What is the terrain? What is the landscape? What can you see when you stop and are still? So I'm not really talking about two different kinds of people. I'm talking about two different ways that each of us is. Each of us is mountain. Each of us is clouds and water. And we're not even talking about a kind of oscillation between one state and another, like Penny and me throughout the retreat. We're talking about dropping down to that place where we know that mountains and clouds and water are the same thing. It's as though there is one hand and sometimes it's closed and sometimes it's open. Sometimes it is abiding deeply someplace, like a mountain. Sometimes it is abiding nowhere, like clouds and water. And then over time, in our friendliness to the world, in our deep habitation of the Bodhisattva vow, we begin to see that both of those things are true simultaneously. That it is our very ability to abide deeply in that place where it's all one, all the vows are on the same ground and they're the same vow. It is our ability to abide deeply there that allows us to move moment by moment by moment, abiding nowhere, taking no position, having nothing to protect, nothing to defend. Not caught in the opinions and the habits of a position, a place. Abiding nowhere. But knowing that it is our abiding deeply on the ground where all vows are the same that enables us to abide nowhere, moment by moment by moment. And to love both those things in ourselves and in the world around us.
So for me, anyway, most of that is a very deep and beautiful evocation of something like that ordinary mind state when things start to open up. It might be in a retreat, it might be taking a walk, it might be seated on your cushion when you're not in a retreat. And that simultaneous sense of everything, as Suzuki says, just going as it goes, moving as it moves, being completely simultaneous with a deep sense of stillness, nothing moving, nothing changing. Both those things at once. The moment toward the end of what Joan said that I thought might be a troublemaker, though I had in mind maybe newer Zen students than all of you guys, is that notion of, oh, not getting stuck with any opinions, letting the mind move completely freely without, she doesn't say prejudice, but without sticking to a given view or opinion or model. It seems to me there's a truth to that in the moment when everything is both abiding deeply and abiding nowhere, that if somebody comes and interviews you and says, what's your opinion of all that? It seems really silly and really extra. There are moments when opinions seem really to have fallen away, or as Wallace Stevens says in a poem, we reason about them with a later reason. It's really kind of later that we affix labels and opinions to that moment. But if we're worried about needing to aggressively bark at all the opinions that will return tomorrow or the next moment or next week and keep them very far away from our new Zen state of being, it's pretty clear that we're asking for a lot of trouble. So the wager would be maybe that our relations to our own opinions and models is slightly changed, that something has happened in the way we hold those things. My favorite moment in the talk that the Dalai Lama gave to the giant auditorium full of people the last time he was here was when he said, I have plenty of opinions, but they're just opinions. And that seemed to be both, very easy with his own prejudices, opinions, ways of viewing things, preferences, and also standing slightly outside of them. So what I'm interested in mostly talking about, though we may not get there till next week for some of this, is what happens when we're back in opinion land and judgment land, and how do we hold that, and how does our practice change how we hold that, and what are some connections we can make to that. I want to emphasize that it seems to me that the causality in Zen practices is really sort of wildly multiple, and so there are any numbers of ways that that moment of abiding nowhere and abiding deeply might be related to the moment of walking down the street or sitting on your cushion and feeling beleaguered by either your opinion or the fact that nobody will conform to your opinion if you're holding the opinion pretty strongly. So one thing that's a pretty common experience in Zen practice is that if something begins to open up for you in whatever way, and you have one of those moments that feels like abiding nowhere and abiding deeply, that will unsettle in some sense the sort of stuck quality of some of your opinions and judgments. You'll find that you can't take them quite as seriously as you did. And then the other way it can work, of course, and a lot of us are familiar with this, is that little openings, little shifts in those moments when we're on the cushion or off the cushion and our opinions are jabbering away at us, when somehow that loosens or it seems funny or we might just as well hold the opposite opinion, that in a really kind of unlikely way, that just sort of grubby little thing that just happened in relation to our own views of how things ought to be can precipitate a really big falling into that place of abiding nowhere and abiding deeply, where at least for a while it all just falls away. So I'm trying to talk in what I'll be saying for a couple more minutes today and then next week also about a couple things that we tend to focus on often. And one way to talk about it would be, I suppose, the relation between the Dharma and karmic work, just the sort of ordinary business of being human and being a particular self with a particular history, and how we encounter that in our Zen practice. And then also the odd disproportion between sort of tiny little means and gigantic ends sometimes, the way in which very small shifts in terms of something very local can open up something in a really big way. So I just want to do one more thing for today, and then we'll pick up again in a couple weeks after the Cohen seminar. The place where I want to go is really the bucket work aspect. I want to talk about some of my sense, both from my own practice and from reading I've done of various kinds, of some of the ways in which, the bucket work of negotiating our own opinions and how they crop up in our practice on the cushion or off can be worked with. I want to talk a little bit from a slightly different vantage point right now about a slightly different way of thinking about the relation between those kind of deep moments and the not so deep moments maybe that follow from them. You know, so we're back in the sort of everyday world. We're just our regular selves. We're not feeling something particularly profound going on at the moment, but maybe things are shifted in an important way because of our practice nevertheless. So I'm going to get there, and again, this won't take very long, but by a really tiny quotation from Wordsworth, who can be really annoying. I mean, he can be really unctuous and moralizing, and probably this passage will have some of that in it. But he's also a very great poet, and the Prelude, which is sort of the long book-length poem about how he got to be the poet who could write the great epic, you know, is something I want to quote from just a little bit here. So, this is from book two, and it's all pretty autobiographical. And as I said, there's something kind of annoying about some of the language that embodies it or conveys it. So he's talking about babies in general, but in a way he's talking about, oh, what was it like to be a little kid in my life? And what about my mom? So my notes for this talk always say it's a talk about Wordsworth's mom. But anyway. Bless the infant babe, for with my best conjecture I would trace our being's earthly progress. Bless the babe nursed in his mother's arms, who sinks to sleep, rocked on his mother's breast, who with his eye drinks in the feelings of his mother's eye. For him, in one dear presence, there exists a virtue which irradiates and exalts objects through widest intercourse of sense. No outcast he, bewildered and depressed. Along his infant veins are interfused the gravitation and the filial bond of nature that connect him with the world. What I think he's talking about there is that sense that, and clinical psychology is all over this, of course, too, that that for an infant, that sense of security and at-homeness in the world really begins with that very unimaginably close physical and emotional bond with the mother, and that in many ways sort of then spills over into our relation to the other stuff around us and the world, that in some way there's a kind of, there's a sort of bonded space to the mother that becomes models even to call the world, that becomes kind of the source as well as a model for how we feel about stuff around us. I remember when I was making money as a graduate student in New York that I worked for this odd psychoanalytic tutoring place where we were tutoring kids, but they also had emotional problems. And the director of the place, this is a tiny digression, but turns out she was the daughter of Freud's rabbi, which is kind of interesting. So she had some kind of, she was also friends with Freud's daughter, Anna Freud. Anyway, I remember seeing movies that she was, you know, involved in, I think, making or consulting for. And it turned out that mothers had two tendencies that weren't perfect. So one, I mean, they must have many others, but in terms of what I'm talking about, there were some mothers who were really great at sort of cradling the infant or the toddler or the about to be toddler and keeping it really close and making it feel nurtured. But they were a little clingy, and they had a little time sort of letting the infant go and sort of wander around the rest of the space. And other mothers were really good at sort of letting the kid go and sort of keeping a really kind eye on it as it wandered around the space. But when it came back and wanted to hug them, you know, maybe a little tense or not so good. And I think the idea is that if a mother could do both those things, there really is that that the space that the infant explores really in some way is in some easy way an extension of that bond, you know. All right, so well and good for Wordsworth, and then again in a kind of abstract way, here's a bad moment, and for $20, try to figure out the sort of sad biographical thing that actually happened underneath all this language. It's just a couple lines, but for now, a trouble came into my mind from unknown causes. I was left alone, seeking the visible world, nor knowing why, the props of my affections were removed. That's like a hyper abstract way of talking about what terrible thing that happened to him. Any guesses?
Abandonment.
His mother died when he was actually eight by then, but his mother died. Anyway, so here's the next thing that he says, right? The props of my affections were removed, and yet the building stood as if sustained by his own spirit, and that gets an exclamation mark. All that I beheld was dear, and hence to finer influxes the mind lay open. And so the claim there is that even once that original source of that sense of at-homeness in the world dies, that still flows out into the world and it's there, that sense of home at-homeness does not disappear. So the analogy I want to make, I can get there by thinking a little bit about two different things that Norman Fisher said, one of which sort of strikes me as more like what I'm talking about than the other one. So the first one is, there's a talk that we played a few years ago where he's summarizing and reading from a lot of a book by Katagiri, and he says that there are these powerful moments that are like the abiding deeply and abiding nowhere moment that Joan evokes, and then when you're outside them, you're really outside them, and they're just a memory to you. And he talks about the memory is important, but he really wants to insist on that really sharp separation between the moments when things really have fallen open and other ordinary things that are going on. That's not like what I was just talking about. There's another moment in another talk. I think Jeff may have been there. It's one of the Samish Island talks where he says, "Oh, we're getting to the end of the retreat, and if you didn't get enlightened yet, you know, don't worry, it's too late. So don't you know, take it easy for the rest of the retreat." He's joking around, of course. And then he says, "Oh, and then you're going to go home, and in a few days you'll just be your old crazy self again," which is like that big separation. And then he says, "Well, but not really, because he says your body remembers that the experiences that you have in a retreat are really deep inside your body, and even when you've forgotten about them, even when you've gone on to something else, even when you feel like you've lost that abiding nowhere and abiding deeply, it's still inside you." And so I'm trying to make an analogy between that and the Wordsworth stuff that I read. So one of the things I want to suggest, and again, all of you know this very well, I guess, but is that having had any experiences of things falling open in a retreat or at other times, that even when we're not there, that experience will color and imbue and shift how even the grubbiest moments and the most difficult moments in our day-to-day lives can feel. So I'm going to leave it there. I've gone on too long already, and try to pick up in a couple weeks with talking some more about the grubby bucket work stuff and ways we might think about that a little bit. So with apologies for having gone on too long, I'd still welcome any brief comments or questions or remarks.
I guess the thing I related to was the no opinions thing, and I, again, coincidentally and independently picked up practice of neither for nor against, which Joan talks about, and I found out it comes from something called Trusting in Mind by the Third Patriarch, a big, long, rather poetic piece, and I've been reading it and just letting it kind of wash over me and. Mom, you know, here and there picking up neither for nor against. Anyway, there was this moment recently where there were cars on my side of the street at home. There's no parking. There were cars in my yard on my side of the street, and I'm like, I'm neither for nor against cars on my side of the street. And then I said, that is not true, because I am against it. And then I thought, what if I could be neither for nor against being against cars on my side of the street? And that's when I was abiding nowhere whatever you said. Yeah.
Deep all, she says
right. That. Yeah. Like everything fell away by me taking it a step further and allowing myself to be against something. So yeah, that's what I thought of when you were talking.
Yeah.
That's
great. Yeah. What that makes me think of is Joan saying a lot that in an important way, Zen is a way of freedom. So there'd be a way in which you could be neither for nor against something that would feel like the most incredibly awful straitjacket, and what you found is exactly the opposite.
Right.
You
know? And I also have to say that it was those things were not back to back. I was really against those cars like the whole day, and then later I realized, wow, I could be neither for nor against my againstness, and that's when it kind of went.
This is that John thing I love, where he says, sometimes I like vanilla ice cream, is you just don't get to prefer. You know, it's like, you just like vanilla ice cream.
Yeah.
Well, I like what you just said, Jill, about how they weren't back to back, they weren't instantaneous, like how it takes some time, it seems, you know. And there's something important about that time of being against, you know, because if it had been instantaneous, wouldn't have been the same feeling, almost.
Well, definitely not the depth of recognition for me. Like, it wouldn't, there was something about, I mean, because to be honest, it was right in my face, but I couldn't see it. And there was something about letting it be in my face for a while that allowed me to get to the next spot.
And I'd appreciate, I think there's at one point in the Dharma dialogue, you guys had the term of the spiritual bypassing. Mm-hmm. It's like instead of doing that thing of like, well, I should be this way, I shouldn't be bothered by this, you know, mm-hmm. repressing and suppressing, it's like, you know, being like, yeah, I'm what it is. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I was in the Dharma dialogue. Mary brought in a book, How to Cook Your Life, by the Soto teacher Uchiyama, which is a commentary on Dogen's instructions to the cook. And I was looking for something that I wanted to use today, and I couldn't find it. But I happened on, just right toward the end of the book, he talks about how one of the things that happens in Zen practice, he says there'll always be that sort of disconsolate, dissatisfied one. It's part of being human, you know. And so one of the things that Zen practice does is it teaches us how to take care of that one. Which it seems to me is like what you're talking about in some way. You know, it's not going to go away, but mm-hmm. you learn how to care for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great.
I guess we're out of time. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. I should do that, though. Does anybody have anything else they want to say? I didn't. Joan's version of, is there anything else that must be said? All right, thank you.